Welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, sponsored by the National Association of Independent Artists.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. I'm Will Armstrong, and I'm a mixed media artist.
I'm Douglas Sigworth, glassblower. Join us as we explore the topics that affect the lives and livelihoods of art show artists. Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. We've been on the air now for 6 months. Whether you're just joining us for the first time or been with us for a while, thanks for listening. Will, how you doing?
I am a little frazzled. You know, I had a couple of weeks between shows. I'm going to try to get out to Bayou City this coming weekend, and I'm not quite there. I've got a couple of pieces I need to finish for sure.
I hear you. We're in the same boat. We're going there as well.
Nice.
It's a 2-day drive, and we're trying to fill in some holes for Madison. We were in the studio yesterday, just feeling that pressure. And this area in Minnesota gets all of those box elder bugs. They are nasty here, and they like the heat, and they just cover the entire wall of our studio. And then they like to dive bomb you and fly into the glass and fly into our face. Anyway, we were having a hell of a day, yes.
You know how many pieces, like if I learned glass blowing, if I, you know, took some lessons from you and you taught me how to do some of the process, yeah. I think I'd blow one piece of glass. And I think that would be like, well, I did it.
There
That's
you go.
It. Like the discomfort, the bugs that you're talking about. Yeah, no, I'm just I'm done. Put me in my little air conditioned studio and let me make my pretty pictures.
Yeah. If mixed media wasn't already an extremely competitive category, I think I could apply under mixed media because I've got box elder bugs in all of my pieces now.
Nice. That's a special technique, Douglas.
Yeah. So we were just like feeling the pressure, trying to make it work. Finally, we just said, fuck it. Let's go for a bike ride and get off the hamster wheel and give ourselves a break.
Good. Hey, it's birthday week here at the podcast. I had my birthday yesterday, 51. You've got yours today. So happy birthday to you, sir.
Happy birthday to you. 51, man. I mean, turning 50 in COVID was kind of like we were able to just kind of move through that transition. I don't know why 51 seems so much older than 50.
I don't know that 51 exists. I deny it. I go the Patton Oswalt route. He's got a whole routine about birthdays. It's like once you pass a certain point, you only get a birthday on the zero until you get to 90, and then you get a birthday every year. Okay. But 51, no birthday.
Nah.
So my wife was great and treated me very well, but man, we don't need to talk about 51. Let's move on.
Let's move on to happier subjects.
Sure. Hey, what do you hear from the NAIA and news? Let's talk about the last couple of meetings.
We've been talking about some of the amenities that have changed since COVID started, like having a little bit more space around our booth, having smaller show numbers. And so these are advocacies that we're working on with NAIA to put forward with the show directors for next year.
There is going to be a survey that goes out. Court Anderson has been huge with that, with getting all of the survey questions together. So it'll be interesting to get everybody's opinion on how things go forward, what they've liked and what they don't like.
Yeah. So to that point, these changes that we've all really enjoyed this year are attainable next year. We've been hearing from the show directors. But so much of this industry is data driven. And Stephen King has told us that he can go to his investors, he can go to his stakeholders, and he can say, this is what the artists want, and this would make for a better show. And they'd say, okay, show me the evidence. Well, the evidence is going to come from the survey. If we answer these questions related to how much money we're bringing into the community through hotels and restaurants, if we talk about dollar amounts, then it lets them know what kind of sales tax is coming in. All of these things to see our shows as a benefit, and it will give the show the ability for grant money, sponsorship money, which can help in keeping our booth fees down. So be looking for the surveys and make the time to do it.
Okay. So he's just about the numbers. We fill out the thing, give him the data. He can take the data to somebody else. It's not just a bunch of artists. It's like, well, I was talking to this guy and that guy. So
yes.
We need that data. So that's why we're doing the survey. That's why NAIA is stepping up and trying to give everybody a voice. It's just another voice, another piece of information to give these directors.
This is a good opportunity to join NAIA. You can log on to the website at naiaartists.org. Click on Join Us, submit your information, and you will get the survey emailed to you. Otherwise, keep an eye out on the social media forums, and you can jump on that way too.
Yep. We try to put those pieces of information out on most of those art fair information groups. I know there's one in particular that thinks it's self-promotion, so you won't be able to see it in, I believe it's Art Fair Reviews. So you won't see it there.
We'll have it on the Independent Artist Podcast page as well. So you can always subscribe and jump on there.
Thanks for cutting me off. All right.
Was that where you were going with it?
No, I was going to say something derogatory that could open me up. So I appreciate you cutting me off.
I'm protecting you there, man.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you. All right. Let's move on, Douglas. We got an email this week from a valued member of our community and avid listener of the podcast, Carla Fox.
Yeah.
So what was she asking?
Well, the gist of her question really comes from the newbie's point of view, a new artist wanting to get into the roadshow market and kind of really didn't know how to do it and what the details were.
It's a common question I get asked. Some younger folks will come around at shows and ask me. There are a lot of different ways we could tackle this. It sounds like a whole show.
It really does. I guess maybe the Cliff's Notes version from me would be, you really have to start with that body of work. Get your body of work ready to go, because that's going to be the bread and butter of your business. And then start going to the shows, see how people do their displays.
How do you display is the second biggest part. I feel like the booth shot, it cuts the fat. Maybe even reach out to somebody like Larry Berman, former NAIA board member and a professional photographer, does an amazing job with advice on how to get the booth together. There's a whole Facebook group just on that subject.
Right.
Research that. Doug will have that in the show notes. I believe it's Art Fair Booth Shots or something like that.
I'll drop that in what the name of it is, and I'll put the link in the episode notes.
Perfect. So I would start there too. And then honestly, I've got three booths. I have a set of pro panels that I can just throw in the truck too. I've got two craft huts. I'd be willing to loan out if somebody was in my area in Santa Fe, or if I was coming to a show, I'd throw my extra stuff in the truck and help somebody out.
Yeah, join the social groups, Art Fair Review, and network with other artists and ask for resources, put out questions. That's basically how a lot of us learned, was by talking to people directly. But now with social media, you can reach out across the airwaves to be able to do that.
Yeah, there are. I join those groups and not be scared to ask a total noob question. Just get in there and just be loud and proud about what you need and be like, hey, I've got my first show coming up, or I want to do this and borrow a booth before I buy pro panels. I want to see if this shit looks any good on the wall. Yeah. So just jump right in there.
And listen to the podcast every week, because there's lots of pearls we're going to drop for you.
That's right. It's we can definitely answer those one-on-one questions. And Carla, thank you for sending that email in. If you guys have questions that you'd like answered on the podcast, you have an interesting topic, you can throw it against the wall and see if it sticks.
Yeah, feel free to send it to independentartistpodcast@gmail.com, or you can post it right on our Facebook or Instagram page at Independent Artist Podcast. I've been making a point at all of these shows since we've been back on the road in July to talk to each of the directors and give them a personal thank you, because I know launching after COVID has been just outright hell for them.
Kisses.
I know.
No, I agree with you. No, it's not an us and them thing. That's good of you. That's great.
I wanted to know what they're going through. And I talked to Mo Riley. I talked to Donna Potts and Anik Dupatty. They all said the issues with permits and the amount of volunteers being so much lower and the higher costs for suppliers has just made their shows so much harder to produce this year. Aside from the whole cold.
And different, too.
Yeah, and different.
I mean, it's like you look at Brookside and what Donna Potts had to do. They didn't get to do their big tent. You know, it was kind of a signature large tent in the center of the show. But they couldn't do that because of COVID. Everybody's doing all outdoor dining and trying to do outdoors because of COVID. It was really, from what I understood, next to impossible to rent the big top.
Oh, right. I guess I thought where you were going with that was that being confined in a tent was not good for COVID transmission. But yeah, the cost, the demand for those tents has been so high. And she said the cost for even getting it for next year is a lot higher than what they can swing.
That's interesting. I wonder if they'll just go outdoors, you know? I mean, that would be fine with a lot of people, I think, for sure.
Pulse shows she sent out a survey on how people felt about it. I believe that there is a strong support for just going without. It was kind of weird to have half the show tented and half the show not. That show in early spring, the weather can just be so unpredictable and the strong spring storms. You know, a lot of people like having the tent.
Sure. I mean, I remember when it snowed one year.
Yes, and that tent came down with the weight of the snow on it.
Did it?
It did.
Wow. Yeah, I was not there that year.
Yeah, so. It came down before setup. So they had to hire the tent crew to come and put it back up again.
Jeez. It's a nightmare. Yeah, so many different things go into planning a show and thinking about all of that. I mean, is it better to have the big top come down or all of our little tops come down? I don't know. That's a tough one.
Right. Well, a couple of the shows that were allocated from earlier in the year to fall, they aren't even going to get a break. I mean, they did the show, they get a day, but then they are rolling right into their spring and early summer 2022 schedule. So these guys have got that pressure going for them as well.
They've probably already started looking for permits and things like that for spring.
Sure.
Getting double permits. That's a lot of work that those shows go through. And I appreciate you talking to those guys, and hats off to the directors who are putting those shows on and doing double time to get ready for us, working for their community, but really helping us out and keeping those venues open.
Right.
I'm just excited we're all going to have venues hopefully coming up into that early spring and summer. So, I'm going to put my blinders on and apply to the shows and just keep going. Hey, Douglas, I applied to my first show. I feel like a big boy. 2022 is coming up.
You did.
Yeah, I did. I applied to Main Street Fort Worth, and
cool.
I feel a little weird about having not gotten my first app out yet, but I finally broke through.
I did something different last night than usual. I did one of those just like I'm just going to get them all out of the way. I think I applied for 10 shows all the way till next spring, which
yeah.
I typically, there's a whole methodology that I hear from people about when to submit those applications. So I hope I didn't shoot myself in the foot by putting too many in too soon. You know, they say don't be the first application in because they're holding back when they jury. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that one.
I don't know. There's all sorts of theories on that. I tend to there are two waves that I apply in when I apply to shows, but this is just how I go. I'll apply to all the shows that I want.
Yep.
And then I'll get that first rejection of the season because we all get them.
Yeah.
And I'll get that first rejection and then I'll do a whole nother round of panic apply. Just like, oh, shit, I'm not going to get anything. And then I'll go through and apply to everything under the sun. And I'll look back and I'll be like, I'm not going to Maryland from Santa Fe in July. Like, it's just not going to happen. But good luck to everybody. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see how those applications shake down.
Yeah, good luck to everybody. We're dropping the ball on the roulette wheel. We'll see how it comes up.
But that's like calculating the variance.
So we're at the point in the podcast where we talk to our special guest. This week I got to sit down and talk with my good buddy Michael Schwegman.
He's pretty cool. I enjoyed your guys' talk.
He's okay.
I really admire his drive for excellence, and it's more than just in his work. You can get in his conversation how he really has this drive to always get better at what he's doing in life.
Well, and it's very methodical, too. He doesn't get particularly ruffled about certain things. He has his work that he feels very strongly about. He works very hard at getting it to be a professional level. He just takes very direct steps to get to where he wants to be.
All right. Up next, we have your interview with ceramic artist Michael Schwegman.
This episode of the Independent Artist Podcast is brought to you by Zap, the digital application service where artists and art festivals connect.
I'm just starting to get organized for winter 2022 in Florida and planning out what shows I'm going to be doing.
Oh, thanks for the panic attack. I appreciate that. I haven't even begun. No, I really appreciate what they're doing for us as an industry.
You know, and it's not just about us. It's about the shows, too. I mean, the shows are able to see our images and create a good jury and then manage all of our information so they can communicate and keep their shows really organized.
I don't know about you, but I find myself late night doom scrolling after that first rejection of the season. So it's always helpful to me to have everything in one place.
That's right. We want to send out our thanks to Zap for sponsoring us this week.
This week, the Independent Artist Podcast is proud to welcome Michael Schwegman to the show. Michael has done everything in ceramics from high-end sculptural work to the beginning of his career where he explored museum-quality functional craft. Thank you so much for joining me, Michael. Can't wait to get into your process.
I wanted to welcome you onto the show, and I've been wanting to have you on here for a while, but the fact that you're one of my closest friends, I kind of was reticent to do it because I don't know that you and I have ever sat down and just talked art show.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of what we both sort of like our lives. So it's always intermingled with, yeah, personal stuff. So yeah, like straight art fair talk. No, I think, yeah, because a lot of times we sit down and it's like, yeah, I don't want to talk art fairs because, you know, we're hanging out.
Yeah. You sit down with your friends and you're like, I kind of choose that as the mark of a good friend. If you sit down to dinner and you don't talk about art shows.
That's right.
And so I mean, it's funny that I'm doing this because a lot of times I really hate talking about art shows. I don't actually enjoy it that much. I want to talk about the other stuff.
Well, it's true. Yeah. But it is, I mean, it's so relevant to, you know, our lives. I mean, we do talk about it. I guess it's just by the time, you know, when you get together with good friends, you know, you can share the other things. It kind of, sometimes I think it can be like a buffer, you know, it's like a safe conversation, right? For people talk about, hey, what show are you doing next? How was that show? Even though you don't even remember, you know, because like how many times you ask somebody at a show, your neighbor, like, okay, so what's next? So what's next? You'll ask them 7 times over the weekend. You don't even pay attention. No, but it's a security blanket kind of conversation.
It is. Sometimes. And I use it on this show all the time. Well, I sit down and I'm like, well, okay, what's next? And I'll probably ask you that.
Well, of course. Well, that is sort of the part of the thrust of the show.
Yeah, for sure.
The industry and how people are. Yeah. But I think one of the things I liked about the show so far, I haven't heard every episode, but because I do save it for when I'm driving. But one thing that I like about it is the, you know, how you, you know, the personalities, you know, it's the people of the business that make it. I mean, people aren't buying, you know, products at the show. I mean, they are, but ultimately they're trying to make human connection.
Well, that's my feeling. Yeah. I feel like art shows will not go away. You know, I've heard the argument that this may be a dying industry, but I think what keeps it going is the fact that we have this face-to-face with our clients, that my customers, like I had one today on Instagram, Ella Richards, she sold a nice piece and it's hanging next to one of mine. She sold it in Plaza and I'd sold the guy one when I was there the last time. And I remember that client because he was talking about his daughter going away to music school and he had this connection because it was a New York piece about a CBGB's, this New York music club. And he was thinking about his daughter making music and her relationship with the city, which is why he bought it. And there's no way he would have bought that from me online without talking to him about music. So, I mean, I do think that our industry is that, you know, that connection.
Yeah, I concur. I mean, it's been dying since I started doing it, right? I mean, everybody's always talking about, oh, you know, you should have been here. Oh, you know, if you were here in the 70s, you know, oh, you should have been here in the 80s. Oh, you should have been here in the 90s. Oh, you should have been here 10 years ago, right? That's always the thing you get.
Well, maybe they should have changed their work.
Well, it's
since
like,
then,
exactly,
maybe that's what's dying.
If you making the same thing that you were in 1983, then yeah, it might be. But yeah, you know, you got a winning strategy. I guess you stick with it. But, I guess everything's dying, but it's, I think of it as an evolution. And you're right. I mean, there's no loss of need for that connection. In fact, people are more aware of the need for that now, right? Because of social media and, you know, COVID recently, you know, things like that where it was supposed to make it so we never had to go out of our houses, you know, social media, that we could just keep contact with everybody. But then we realized how important that was. And so, yeah, I mean, it's changing, right? The internet has changed all businesses, but to me, it hasn't died. I mean, that need for that connection.
Even more so now. You mentioned COVID, and I don't want to beat COVID into the ground, but I feel like the shows, people I'm talking to are having good weekends. You know, they're getting out there and crushing it here at some of these festivals that I've been talking to people. That after they participate, they're like, wow. I mean, the hunger is there and the urge to support. I don't think it's just a buildup of 2 years worth of people now that want art. I feel like it's the personal connection.
That's right.
So hopefully we can keep that going, you know, that energy. I'm reticent to cancel anything, but just because it's been so good out there.
Yeah, it has been. It has been really strong. And I was telling, I think I was telling you guys, maybe in Denver, you know, like this is the good old days, right? Like, you know, at some point in the future, people will be like, oh, you should have been showing right after the pandemic because that's when we were selling. And it's true.
That's
and
the one.
And if for some reason we're still doing this monkey business in, you know, 20 years and there's a new crop of kids, you know, behind us doing this, we'll be like, oh, God, you guys should have been here in 2021,
that's gonna be our legend.
That's when you made the money, Right.
I wish there'd be another pandemic.
If only we could have millions of people around the world dying, we could really do well,
The sunshine after the rain, baby.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to kind of talk to you about and get in the Wayback Machine and kind of start at the beginning, because you have been a ceramic artist and a potter, and you've done everything with clay that I can think of, from functional now to sculptural. But you started out, you went to college. Where'd you go to school?
I started in a little liberal arts school in Michigan in Kalamazoo, so Kalamazoo College. And I was always really good at school, tested at the highest point, it was always the 99th percentile kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I was just always assumed I would go, do some sort of professional, in quotes kind of thing. And so I went up there and I thought, well, maybe I'd be like a math and English teacher, something real heady and intelligent, because I was I was just really good at math and really good at, kind of everything in school. And, but then when I was up there, I did some ceramics. I wanted to do some art and I really liked it. And, I had a background in construction. My dad was a carpenter. So I grew up around doing, hands-on stuff. But, at that age, growing up in the 80s, it was like, well, don't be a worker. You want to use your brain, not your hands,
Okay.
And, that's kind of like, don't be crawling around in the sawdust like me. You need to be a professional, right? Like that's what you're getting right. taught. That's what I was taught. And so I never thought of the idea of working with hands as not, not a bad thing, but just like, well, that was like a lower form of employment. And so
your dad wanted you to, he wanted you to have like a desk job,
to be better, right? Like quote unquote, to be more successful.
This is
somehow.
Like sounds like the very beginning of a the biopic, like the classic bio. I don't want you to be like me, son.
Oh, exactly right.
I mean, get this dirt under your fingernails.
Well, I didn't know, and we have a brother and sister, and we admired him because he was he's a cool dude and worked hard. And he'd be on TV sometimes, if it's camera crews would come around and film like for some news story about unions or something like that, and they're like, oh my god, he's on TV, he's so cool, like we thought that was so cool because dad's on TV, it was a big deal. And then he'd come back and be like, I don't want you to be, I don't want to ever see you on TV like that, so
was he a union guy then?
Exactly. Nice. St. Louis is a very big union guy. Okay. Union town, my brother's kind of like a big part of the union now there too, so that's really good. I'm real happy about it. But anyway, so go to college to be a smart guy, and got into ceramics and really liked it. And, I had an affinity for it, and I was really good at it and got a bit obsessed about it, and did like an internship. And that internship involved going to work for a potter. So I went and found a potter who was doing art fairs, worked for him for about a year.
I remember having a conversation with you at some restaurant or bar after a show at one point. And I mean, your aesthetic and your work ethic, and it, clearly you get that from your dad,
it's like a Midwest work ethic. Yeah.
I remember you talking about your aesthetic and your drive to create. I mean, even kind of cutting into relationships that you've had, like that drive I wanted to talk about too, just to make a certain, I don't know, to get better, that drive to get to where you want it to be.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, yeah, whatever. How would we define success? But I guess trying to be, I don't know, try to get as good, to be the best in the field, whatever the hell that means. Right. Like, I don't even know if there's a reasonable metric for that, but I went to Jesuit high school. And so the idea is, you are the best, you have to be the best, right? Like you're going to go to Harvard, you're going to, whatever, go win a Nobel Prize. I mean, that's, these metrics. And so that was some idea I had, to be the best. And really, like you said, mentioned, four wins, personal relationships, just to improve the work, improve the craft, I mean, part of our obsession in terms of making the artwork and it's like, hey, I got another idea. How can I be better? And, when in the 90s, it's like, okay, I want to be in the top galleries, or then, get in the top shows, or, win the prizes. I don't know if that's exactly what you were alluding to. But
just that idea of when other people are out partying and forego that to go back and get better.
Definitely.
To be in the studio.
Yeah, I did a lot of that. Yeah. a lot of Saturday nights, yeah, just being in the studio all night thinking like, okay, well, after I get, you know, this part done, I'll go out. And then, well, then I'll right. go out. And then, I'll go, and then it's 4 a.m. It's like, I'm still in the studio. And it's like, oh, okay, well, miss that weekend again. Yeah. You know, or had girlfriends who would call and be like, hey, like, would you just come over and see me for a minute, you know? And be like, yeah, but after I go to the studio, and of course they'd be like, well, wait a minute, you'd rather go to the studio than bang. And it's like, well,
that's the drive, right? That's a real drive.
And it's, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but you know, it's like, well, part of my brain was like, well, there'll always be opportunity to bang, but not always opportunity to make work, which is completely ridiculous. But
yeah, you'd feel like going back in the time machine, be like, God, I wish there was more time to bang.
It's like, well, yeah, right, exactly. You know, you need your bang time higher than work time. You know, I think that's the quote, right? That'll be the title of the show, probably.
Bang time more with Michael Schwartzman.
More bang time. Yeah. So yeah, that would be definite, and you know, there's regret there because ultimately you want to have human connections and relationships. But, you know, I also certainly don't regret being good at what I do, you know, and right. putting in the tens of thousands of hours, you know, that's taken me to, you know, develop the technical skills and, you know, whatever the recipes I have for my specific work, but then also, you know, the skill set or the knowledge and the thought, and, you know, I have a certain philosophy about what I do and why I do right. it. You know, that you don't get that by you know, going out and partying. And I'm not saying that one's better than the other. That's just a choice.
No, choices I've made. Yeah. And it's gotten you to where you are. And,
yeah. Yeah.
You'd mentioned about interning or having a kind of a mentorship. Was that with the school or was that somebody that you found on your own? Like, how did you even know to do that?
It was part of the school program. It was a pretty cool program, but the whole school, like they had every semester, or well, it was on quarters, but every year you had to do a special like non-school project. So freshman year was just kind of freshman year, but then you had to do an internship and do a foreign study. And then I forget what the other thing was. And I forget because I didn't finish at that school. I ended up going somewhere else. So I don't remember what the third thing was. But yeah, part of the program there was that you had to do what they called a career development. You know, internship.
Okay.
And so it was like, well, you had to go work with a design firm, or, you know, if you're going to be a doctor, maybe you go, you know, follow somebody around or whatever. But I decided, well, I go find an artist, you know, and that wasn't something that was part of what they did. I mean, specifically, yeah. But, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'll go find a guy to apprentice with or whatever. And so I just found a guy that had a studio up near, you know, in Michigan.
And was he somebody that you admired? Like you admired the work, or is he just like functioning artist?
I'd gone to a little art fair in the town there in Kalamazoo, and he had a booth, and I just saw the work, and I was like, oh, that's nice work. I liked it. It was, you know, it was pottery, but it was it was well done, but it was a more you know, a little more fancy, you know, a little more like artistic, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool.
A little more to it.
Yeah, good design. You know, it wasn't just straight round box, you know, which are fine, but that's not what I was interested in doing. It was more of a sculptural bent. So I found him, and I figured out who he was, and I just called him on the telephone because that's how it worked back in the day, right? You had telephones, and I left him a message on his answering machine or whatever. And then, we just, you know, it was a little process trying to track him down and actually, you know, make it work because, you know, I didn't have email or anything. And I went out there and worked with him for a little bit. Did some art fairs, so I didn't know about art fairs really at all, which was not atypical for a teenager.
It's not. Yeah, I mean that's it's also kind of atypical for the academic lifestyle to point you in that direction because a lot of people, especially, you know, I don't know about ceramics, but in, you know, 2D fine art, they're like, if they look way down their nose, I'm not getting invited back to my college to come do any talks. Art festivals are like, I don't know. I look at it. I've said this a bunch of times, but I look at it as almost like rock and roll middle class. We're working the clubs, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when I ended up eventually transferring to University of Illinois, where I got my degree, and I had a lot of really great professors there, but I had a couple people who were like, well, you should just stop doing that. You shouldn't even do art fairs. And, well, that's how that's how literally I was making, you know, I was making pottery and put my way through college. And at the time, I'm like, well, you know, that's how I pay the bills, you know, making mugs and bowls and bass is, you know, for art fairs.
How do you think I'm sitting in here in your class?
Yeah.
You
know, and I'm like, well,
I'm out here, if you're paying for it, you're.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I was paying for it. Right. And they're like, well, no, you should like just work at a restaurant or deliver pizzas. I mean, this is the conversation. I'm like, well, wait, what? I mean, it's insane. You're like, well, this is like interfering with your work. I'm like, no, I'm making sculpture, you know, doing all this other work. I mean, I was making work, right?
Right.
You know, making the work in college and then.
And it's not affecting your work. I mean, I understand we've had this conversation before too. Like I can tell, I went to school as an illustrator and I could tell when illustration majors or graphic artists would go work for Six Flags or King's Dominion and do caricature art. They'd come back and it would completely fuck their work up. Their line quality was King's Dominion all of a sudden because they were taught, they were run through that mill of like practice. But you're out there honing those skills and they still are saying no.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say they were 100% wrong, you know, because, you know, everything you do, like you said, you know, even the King's Dominion, that might be too much of a dead end, but you know, everything you do, of course, affects, you know, your style and your work. And so I wouldn't say they're 100% wrong, but I thought it was very short-sighted. Now, I will say that most of my professors thought it was like super cool. They're like, wait, you know, you're making work and you're selling work. I mean, that's awesome. And, you know, and they liked what I did. And of course, you know, I would even do like farmers markets in Champaign-Urbana. You know, and I'd see those guys at the market and be like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, someone would buy my pots, you know. So most people were very, very supportive. You know, the academics were. But there was, you know, some pressure. But you know, overall, I mean, whatever, I got my degree and I, you know, got whatever the prizes at the end were, you know, they think you're good. You know what I mean? Whatever, like the, you know, the kind of you graduate sort of with honors sort of thing, whatever that is. And I got my degree and, you know, kept doing it. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, it wasn't a ton of pressure against. It was just, you know, a little bit, you know, I mean, I know that other people get a lot more pressure. And I think if, you know, if I wasn't completing my stuff on time, you know, or if I wasn't showing up with quality, you know, assignments, they would have had more of a point, you know, but also like we mentioned before, because I wasn't chasing relationships very seriously, you know, either friendships or romantically, you know, I wasn't very good at those. You know, I had a lot more time to, you know, to make, to make artwork. You know, that was the obsession.
That kind of drive is surprising in a young person, but knowing you, not necessarily so much. I mean, well, I understand your aesthetic and kind of your drive, but that existed. I've known you since you were more of a functional potter too, because you went and did functional for years.
Right.
In spite of your rugged good looks.
I know people like, well, wait, you're a potter? Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're 22. I mean, it's like Aaron Heckenberg has said, he looks like the picture that comes with the frame.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, it is funny.
But no, you've been out there, like you started out functional and, how many years were you out there just doing that?
Well, I started making, you know, 95 until, and then, you know, the work evolved, you know, so I did pots, but they, you know, they were more like art pots or something, you know, more, I was trying to make pottery for museums or something like that. If that makes sense, or at least it made sense in my mind that museums would see this really high quality bowl and put it in their museum, because it was true. I mean, there are nice pots in museums, and that was kind of.
But that's your goal at that time was more like, you know, Smithsonian kind of.
Yes, that's right.
You know, ACC, some of those ACC shows.
The Baltimore ACC, you know, the retail only, the, you know, Philly Museum, Smithsonian Museum, American Craft Exposition, which is the big one, you know, in Chicago. Right. You know, those were, you know, the big shows where federal judges go and buy artwork. You know, that was the big time, right? That was, you know, the people in those shows are on the cover of all the trade magazines. That was like, that was the goal, right? That was,
right.
You know, how can I be the best? Well, I'm the best if I do all those shows, right? That's, you know what I mean? That's where you got to be. Right? Or at least if you're not in all those shows, you're definitely not. That was the idea I had, you know, back then. Right. So,
but you were also trying, I mean, you're also doing other shows too, because I saw you at some of the other ones.
Sure. I mean,
it's all just grinding it. I mean, you were on the grind.
I mean, you got to make money is what I meant, to say. And so make a bunch of bowls and try to make fancy pots, if you want to call them those. And do, you know, do B shows and then, you know, try to get into the A shows. Like, oh, you know, if I could just get to Cherry Creek, that would be my, you know, that would be the end of, you know, that, then I'd have made it. You know, if I get
what you're chasing.
And then one day I'll get in Smithsonian and then I'll really be there, you know, or something like this.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is the the fantasy.
Right.
So yeah, that became, you know, kind of the notion. So I, you know, made that work, and that the pottery evolved from 95 until early 2000s, mid 2000s. You know, it was still, but it became more sculptural. It was always very like trying to be high end pottery. Right. And so, you know, it wasn't just straight functional. And, you know, but then I started attaching more doodads to them, and spouts with like, you know, vases with multiple spouts and, you know, teapots that weren't functional and had very sort of figurative kinds of parts. And the questions that kind of kept coming up from not customers, from people who were in my booth but didn't buy, were, well, what is that supposed to be? What is that? Why is this like this? You know, it was these questions. Well, what is that? Is that like a heart? Or is that like a, you know, is that like a muffler or something? Like, what is that? You know, because right. Without pictures, you know, but if you know that work from the period of, let's say, early 2000s on. And I made this kind of work in college. I just never showed it at art shows. This question kept coming up. And so what I figured was not that these people were stupid. It's like, well, no, it's just a vase, man, with multiple holes in it. Like, what's the big deal?
Right.
And so I'm like, well, I could sit there and go, well, you guys are just stupid because you don't understand. But instead, I can say, well, wait a minute, they're asking me a question. And the question is, well, what are you trying to do? You know, like you're not convincing me of anything. You're in between, right? You're not making a pot and you're not making a sculpture that I can understand. You know, they're saying I'm confused is what they're saying, right? They're not saying I'm stupid. They're saying I don't understand what you're trying to say. And so that made,
so you're not saying it loud enough, or you're not saying it more clearly enough.
Clear, right. It wasn't articulating the vision. And of course, I didn't know. I was like, well, I couldn't even tell you what my reference point was. I said, well, it's architecture, human body bits, architectural bits, you know, industrial parts. You know, that was what I was referencing, but not obviously not clearly enough, right? I was just sort of hemming and hawing about it.
Right.
And so then I don't know.
Well, that's interesting because people, I don't know, a lot of times in what we do for a living in our industry, if somebody does say something that we think is stupid,
yeah,
you know, that's a pretty astute observation to turn it back on yourself. And you're like, okay, well, maybe I'm not being clear.
Yeah.
What's the common denominator? The common denominator is always me.
Right.
And if I'm not being clear enough in my articulation,
yeah, well, it's kind of like
that's what needs to change.
Like if everybody is driving like an asshole, maybe you're the asshole. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if everybody's stupid, maybe you're the worst.
Yeah. Everybody I date is a bitch.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Why?
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Right. It's
yeah.
Like, well, you know, nobody gives me what I want. It's like, well, maybe you've got to change your expectations. You know,
all of my neighbors are assholes. Yeah. Well, really? Is it that? Because they were.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So that, you know, that's an observation that comes with, you know, being wrong about it, like because you think everybody's an asshole or they're stupid. But it also, you know, it comes with wanting to be better. And so, yeah, so then that's kind of how it led to this work that I'm known for more now, which is, you know, a lot more representational, you know, because I mean, really, I just sat down and people, you know, they would say things like, what is that? Because I had these vases with all these spouts coming out of them, right? And they're always trying to say, well, what is that, right? What is that? It's like a heart. It looks like all these valves and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I just said, you know what? I'm just going to make a thing. And so I sat down and like, okay, all right, jerk offs, right? I mean, this is, I'm being, you know, being light here, but it's like, all right, guys, you know, you want a thing, I'll make you a thing, right? Like, you want it to look like something, I'll make it look like something. All right. You know, so I sat down and I said, I'm going to make some paint cans. And so I just like, you know.
Make some what?
Paint cans.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I just like, okay, well, paint cans, just a cylinder, right? I mean, that's it. So I threw a few of these and I, you know, made, you know, trimmed them, make them look like they had lids on them, you know, put little knobs on them, put them in a kiln, fired them. They came out. I was like, oh, these are going to be hilarious, right? It's going to be funny. Then I put little wire handles on them, and then they're sitting on the table in my studio. And I'm like, oh, wait, these are like really cool. Like, you know, they're like,
they are. Well,
they're, you know, it was the rare moment, like what I made was better than what I thought it would be. You know, I had thought that it was going to be something just funny. Right. Like, oh, he'll be, it's like a silly thing, but they were way more than that, you know? And I don't think that, I don't know, for me, it doesn't happen that often that the thing that I make is better than what I had set out to make.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. There's something in that. I remember another artist telling me about one of my compositions. He's like, well, it's a dynamite composition, but I don't see it selling anywhere. And it has become my biggest seller too, like that piece. You know, I've done different versions of that thing,
which is what we do for a living. You know, I feel like you have to sometimes repeat your vision a lot in this, which is why maybe the gallery world is, it looks down its nose because, you know, we are grinding it. That's a different subject. Yeah,
but, you know, all the big artists, you know, you see a piece that's well known. I mean, they made 50 versions of it, right? I mean, they painted it usually many times before they got there, or where they continued to, you know, do it over and over until it finally worked out the way they wanted.
Right. So you've created this paint can, like, okay, I'll show you one.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember the first time you showed it, what the reaction was, or what the general reaction was the first time you showed those pieces?
Yeah. You know, I think I showed them, I want to say it was Atlanta ACC in 09 or 08, 09 maybe.
That's a tough one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's tough because it's, you know, those AC shows tend to be wearables and jewelry, you know, dominated. I mean, I've sold work there, but they were never great.
Sure. I did find that to be the case in Atlanta. Yeah. But, you know,
well, at that time, I still had a lot of pottery kind of forms in the booth, and then I had the paint cans. So it was confusing, right? Because you had this mix, and like, why do you have these paint cans here, right? Because they look like paint cans. And, you know, people are like, well, wait a minute, did you not finish cleaning up? And they weren't being like trying to be flippant. They thought that I just had left junk out, you know, that I actually had.
They're very representational.
That I hadn't put everything away. And so, but then when I would, you know, show people, I think I ended up selling a couple, you know, like right away. And then I kind of kept doing that. But then as the shows went on that year, you know, I started building more pieces, you know, that were sculptural, representational. And then so it started to make more sense, right? But still, people would come by and go like, well, why do you have paint cans? Like, oh, I have a whole garage full of this crap. Like, you know, oh, do you want to come by after the show? And I have a whole bunch of stuff you could buy all my old junk. And they were being sincere. They thought I had a booth full of old junk, not that it was all made out of clay. And in my mind, again, it was like, well, guys, just look at this stuff. I mean, it doesn't look like a paint can, but it looks like what you think a paint can looks like, right? It's like a memory of the object. Like people say, oh, you do trompe l'oeil. Well, not exactly. It's not trompe l'oeil. I mean, it does fool the eye, which is what that means, literally. But it means, I'm not trying to make it look exactly like that thing, but I want it to
look. But it looks more like that thing than that thing even looks.
Yeah, it's like Elvis going to an Elvis impersonator competition, you know, and losing because some other guy looks more like what we think Elvis looks like than he does.
Right.
Right, who acts more like Elvis than Elvis.
I don't remember Elvis actually having stars and a moose knuckle, but he's got it.
Yeah. It's like the thing, you know, the parts of a thing that we remember, right? The memory, the nostalgia, you know, the bits that, you know, we filter these things down, right? This goes for objects and for people, right? Where we remember that guy. You know, he was always this way. It's like, well, no, he wasn't. You know, like, that wasn't true, but that becomes true in our brain. Right.
And
so
it does.
That, so that memory.
I mean, from there, any kind of art, there all down to movies. I mean, like Darth Vader never actually says, Luke, I am your father. That's not the quote.
Right.
But that's how we remember.
That's how we remember. Right. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, that's what sort of makes sense. So if someone were to refilm that scene and have him say that, you'd be like, oh, yeah, that nothing's changed. It's exactly right. Yeah. But it's not true. And so with the paint cans and then with, you know, the future objects have done, it's about making them look like the memory of that thing or like through a filter. Right. So, I mean, they're overscale and they, you know, they're a little bit mushier, right. Because they're ceramic. So, anyway, the response was good and it kind of kept going. And then it was clear in my vision about what I was trying to do, I was like, well, what else would be in grandpa's garage? Right. You know, I got old paint cans and buckets and it's like, okay, make these old tools. And like, I don't know why I was doing them exactly. And it sounds ridiculous because of what we started to talk about earlier, but it just seemed to make sense, right? These things seem to be cool objects and fun objects and something that wasn't typically found in ceramic. I mean, there's some history of, you know, ceramic artists making tools and that. So, I mean, I didn't invent the idea at all. But
did you find the narrative in your work kind of after the fact, like the explanation?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You made what you wanted to make and then you figured out what it meant later.
That's correct. Yeah. That's fairly typical for me. There's a certain amount of intuition. It's like, well, that's a good idea. I don't know why, but I'm going to do it. You know, and then later I figure out, well, why did I think it was a good idea? Because I know I have a reason. I just don't always know what that reason is. Right. I mean, I'm pretty introspective, but I don't try to let that get in the way of chasing something. And sometimes they aren't, you know, sometimes the thing, you know, doesn't work out. But when I do get a thing done and it's successful, then I have to figure out, why did I pick that thing? And so I was in, I think it was in Plaza, had a claw hammer, you know, just a regular like framing hammer on the wall. I mean, it was a ceramic one. This guy came in and he was looking at it, you know, really checking it out. And then he called to his friend, who I found out was his brother. And I don't remember the guy's name exactly. He's like, "Hey, Gary, come in here. Come in here." It's like, "Look at this. This is Dad up on the wall," you know? And I was just like, Jesus Christ. I mean, it's so obvious, right? Cause like my dad was a carpenter and, yeah, and you know, that whole thing. And I'm like, how, you know, how blind could I have been, you know, to the, you know, to the understanding of what my own work was about, right? You know, it was about memory and people and that history of, you know, my dad and my family and, you know, just me growing up and what's been valuable and important to me. And so, you know, they ended up buying the piece, you know, but then it was like, it was a very clear, you know, not, I would say like I figured everything out. And I was like, oh, geez, well, of course, this is what I'm doing, where I've talked about the memory and you know, how these objects are refer to people, right? Like, it's like, okay, you can see a hammer and you think of a dad, or you see a stethoscope and you think of, you know, your favorite aunt who's a vet or a doctor, or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, and then doing, you know, I do these other objects, which kind of look like military things or revolvers or flags, and, you know, so it's dealing with like memory and history and the value of these objects. You know, it's, most of these are like functional objects, but they're not functional, right? They're ceramic, oversized, goofy ceramic and you know, objects. You can't use
them. But they make you want to hold them. You know,
they do.
There's a danger in your work too about it being so personal and how we show it.
But yeah, well, right.
That,
yeah.
I mean, they are so personal and they feel really good in your hand. Like the first time you did the revolver, I wanted to pick it up, and and you're like, "Well, you're fine.
You know? Yeah, you're just not gonna fall apart, right?
Yeah.
The function of the object is no longer the value of it, right? I mean, in terms of like, well, the hammer doesn't drive a nail, the gun doesn't fire. But it's what is the memory of the story, right? And so these things that we, you know, like a paint can, right? It's a piece of junk, right? I mean, you know, you paint the wall, you throw it away, but why is this thing beautiful? Why is this thing, you know, I can't give every answer because, you know, why somebody thinks it's beautiful, it's kind of a personal story. But I think it's surprising, right? That we can look at these tools, you know, I mean, they're not tools, the ceramic interpretations of these tools and objects and say, wow, this is really beautiful. Because normally it's just a piece of crap sitting in the back of your pickup truck, you know, but here, you know, becomes this really wonderful thing. You know, it's part of a culture too, right? I mean, I'm a white Midwestern male, you know, right? I have a certain culture. We don't generally think about that because we talk about culture. We're usually thinking of other groups, right? It's like, oh, Native American culture, New Mexican culture, you know, whatever. Like, that's kind of how we often use it. But it's like, well, of course, you know, you and I have culture, whatever that is, right? You're from Virginia, so you have some of that, you know, whatever that is. And so, you know, I'm, you know, part of what my culture is being American and being from the Midwest and being male and being a worker and, you know, being, you know, blue collar, you know, whatever you want to sort of add on to that litany.
It's not often considered culture. You know,
I mean, yeah, that's, and like, there's like
making those objects create, you have to consider them because that's what they're for.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, that was a Des Moines, maybe, you know, it was a real big piece and it looks like a valve, right? Like you'd find in an oil field. This guy comes walking and he's pretty rough looking guy. He's no shirt on, shaved head, tats, and really, I mean, he's ripped, right? You know, this guy's been lifting heavy shit every day since he was like 4 years old, you know, he's like a big dude. And he's walking, you know, strutting down the street, not looking at any booths. And he looks and he sees my booth and you just see him mouth, "What the fuck?" And he comes storming over to my booth and he's like looking around. You just see him just swelling up. Like he's like sucking in air. He is like raging. Yeah. And he calls over to his buddy. He's like, "Timmy, come over here, man. Look at this shit." And he's pissed. And I'm sitting in the back of the booth, you know, I'm like, "Oh, here we go," you know. And I come out and I'm like, "Hey, man," like, before he can even get going, it's like, "Hey, this is all ceramic." And he's like, and he just looks at me like I told him to go fuck his mother. And he's like, "What'd you say?" I'm like, I said, "It's all ceramic." He's like, "What? What do you mean?" I'm like, "I make this all out of clay." He's like, "What, like this?" And he points at the valve. And the way it is I can pull it apart. It's like a jar kind of. Okay. So I lift the top off, which you would never do with a real valve. And he's like, "Wait, what?" And he just looks at it. He's like completely confused now, right? Because he thought that this was all
just, you know, his stuff.
His stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he saw these tools and, you know, and he's like, you know, so I showed him and I picked up a paint can and I picked up a wrench and I handed it to him. And he's like, and so he could see that it's clay and not steel. And he's like, wait, so you make all these things? And I was like, yeah, it's all clay. And, you know, whatever. He's like, oh man, like I thought you just, he goes, cause I got a whole bunch of these in my yard. I, you know, this is how I work. So he's, you know, he's a roughneck. He's an oil worker guy.
Yeah. Right?
And he, you know, and he just thought I had taken all of his culture and trying to sell it back to him through 10 times the price, right? I mean, this would be just as offensive as me driving a truck full of tomahawks onto a Native American reservation and saying, hey guys, you know, come buy my shit. You know, it would be really uncool at the very least, yeah. Right? And
so, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, who the fuck are you? You know, white boy wearing a fitted shirt.
Yeah, we've talked about this before too, but those conversations, a lot of times it's like, okay, you've got this guy coming in off the oil field or whatever, and you know he's likely not to buy the piece, but that might be the most engaging conversation you have all weekend.
Yeah.
You know, and it certainly was memorable because, you know, you've told me that story. I wanted to hear it on the air, obviously, but I've heard that story before, and it's always engaging, and I love hearing it. I know some people, I don't want to talk to that guy. He's never going to buy anything. And it's like, well, you know, maybe the person listening to you that in that conversation and that engagement might be. And it also might stick with you in order to dictate your work later on in a way that you hadn't imagined.
Well, yeah, you're 100% on that. I said, yeah, at least those two things. One is you can use those opportunities in terms of selling work at a show, you know, telling that guy your story. And meanwhile, there might be a buyer in the street who's listening and then they'll come in and buy something. So, I mean, there's definitely a strategy there. And then, but like you said, the, you know, what that did for me was make it a lot clearer about what I was doing, you know, in terms of making, you know, cultural artifacts or some version of that. Right.
Right.
And so yeah, it was, you know, at least those two things. And there's more to it, you know, because, you know, you have a story and it could be a funny story you tell later, or like, I almost got my ass kicked over my artwork someday, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, at least I don't think my work's offensive, but, you know, it was, right. You know,
to him, it was.
It was at first, you know, I mean, once he figured it out, then you know, he was actually very excited about it. But, I mean, it teaches, you know, teaches you. And I mean, I'm not always looking for a lesson in everything in life, you know, not like that. But that was a good one because it helped me learn what I was doing.
But you've got to be a sponge. You have to soak it all in. This is funny because I have Dylan Straczynski coming up as an interview too. And then he and I have talked about. he's an all right dude. Yeah, I'm just gonna wind him up and get him to do impressions of people.
There you go.
He can do everybody.
Yeah.
But the thing, it'll be an interesting segue to go from my talk with you into my talk with him, because I do believe he'll be next. But he also has a very high aesthetic, a very I'm trying to think about the what word I'd say besides just like, it's almost like a museum kind of aesthetic.
Very discerning, right?
Very.
Yeah.
And but you guys share that, but then you've also found, and we don't need to get into specifics about items, but I feel like you finally figured out a way to make money at shows too, where it's kind of been a struggle at times, and now it's kind of like, okay, I feel like you're hitting this kind of groove, and to balance that is it gets kind of tricky. So but that aesthetic never changes. I always look at it like a piece of pie. It's like, okay, well, you look at the pie chart or the wheel of pie, and it's like, okay, well, here's what I'm capable of as an artist. Here's what I'm capable of as an artist that I like and what I'm willing to create. And then within that same piece of pie is art that I'm willing to create that it also sells.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's the thing, because, you know, I want to make work that feels important. You know, that has a real conversation, whatever real means, but, you know, has some kind of serious conversation about serious things, right? Like, that's, you know, I have a sense of humor, obviously. You know, I try not to take myself seriously, but I take the work very seriously. I take the business seriously, and I want to do well. And, you know, I still have that idea about, you know, some sort of high culture, I guess, right? And so if I'm going to make a thing, I want it to be worthy of that. And I understand these are all kind of subjective words to use, but But, you know, I have a, you know, a sense of craftsmanship with the work, but also a sense of craftsmanship with the concepts. So, you know, I try to keep a standard of craftsmanship and creation of the form of the thing, but also in the form of the concept. And yeah, so it's, you know, whenever I, you know, have some ideas, I'm like, well, is this going to be just a silly object? Like, I don't want my work to be silly or goofy, right. You know, and it works for some people. It's just not for me. Like, I'm not silly or goofy. You know, it's just not the way I want to be. And so, but I have found a few things that I made that I was like, well, I'm worried about it being silly. And then they weren't silly. They're actually very cool. And people buy them. And so it's like, oh, that's really nice to be in that position where I've created some things that sell really well. Like you call them like art fair gold or whatever. That sell
yeah,
really
that's
well.
Dylan's turn we're going to talk about for sure.
So that sell well, but also satisfy, you know, my need to keep some, you know, personal level of integrity to the work. You know, I mean, that's important. And, you know, I'm okay to be checked. And I always tell people like, hey, look, you know, if I got some horn growing out of my head, you know, freaking tell me, you know. It's like if you're at a show and you're not selling anything and everybody's around you selling, you're like, you know, like I'm in a good mood. I'm like trying to do everything right. Like, what the hell's going on? And if somebody could just come up to you and say, hey, well, yeah, like, you know, your work's just not that good. Or, you know, hey, you know, like your work's good, except it's too much. It's too crowded. Or, you know, these pieces over here, I think that's really changed, you know, that's hurting the vibe of your work. Or, you know what, you're facing the sun or you're not facing the sun, you know, whatever. Like,
sure. No, you know, sometimes it can be pretty obvious.
Sometimes,
but it is.
Maybe not to you, right? Like, it's the right. artist standing there, you know, and you're like, what the hell's going on? But anyway, so, you know, when you're one of these sort of tortured brain people trying to be so serious about your work, and I think Dylan's that way a bit too, right? He's trying to be very serious about his ideas, and he is. But, you know, there's a challenge there because then you can watch somebody who can do something, you know, very simple and what you might call trite and make, you know, $1 million, you know, and, you know, there can be some jealousy there and whatever, you know, like that's not your, I mean, I used to get really worried about it and try to, you know, like, well, talk to the directors and be like, hey, you know, well, this stuff doesn't belong here, you know, whatever, like, you know, is this the standards you want?
Well, if you ever want to meet a bitter, cranky artist, then find somebody that does whimsy. Because that shit will beat you down. The conversations poor people have to have. I mean,
I couldn't imagine.
It beats them down.
You know, to keep that, because, you know, I'm an introvert, you know, so I can have conversations, but, you know, it drains me. You know, like so many of us. And, you know, the amount that, you know, they are like jewelers, right, have to deal with, you know, people who have to engage all day long, you know, at such a high level. I think that's also too why I avoid like the silly work or, you know, something that's too whimsy.
Yeah.
Because, I don't think I have the brain power for it, you know, the stamina to deal
with
that crowd.
That's what it boils down to. I feel like you and I can step into our booth or step back out of it and get that wave of a conversation, whereas opposed to the jewelers who are like, you know, constantly inundated,
constant,
can't ever leave their booth because somebody can walk away with a, you know, a high dollar piece. Yeah. Their nicest piece fits in a pocket, palm it in their hand.
Yes.
Douglas and I have talked about like different superstitions that artists have and luck. We've had a funny conversation about luck. How do you feel about superstition and luck?
I think it's funny.
Yeah.
You know, I'll joke about it, but I mean, I'm a pretty firm believer in evidence and science. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a pretty firm believer. I believe in evidence and nothing else.
Yes.
Like I think that, you know, I think there's a possibility there are ghosts or spirits or, you know, God or whatever. Like, I'm not going to say you can't prove a negative, right? Like,
sure.
You can't say it definitely doesn't exist, but I don't have any reason to believe so. Yeah, ghosts certainly could be here, but I've never seen evidence. And with all the particle physicists and all that in the world, if ghosts exist, right, like, for example, then, like, if people are seeing them, then there has to be something, right? Then the light is, then they're affected by light, right? Because you can't see a ghost unless light is bouncing off of it, right?
Yeah.
And all these particle physicists, with all of the stuff that they look at, which is way over my head, you know, but I mean, I understand it to a degree. They've never encountered any kind of material or change in materials that indicate the existence of these kinds of objects like ghosts.
Right.
So not saying they don't exist, but there's definitely zero proof of that. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it's a very unromantic way of looking at it. So yeah. I would say the same with like luck, is that I mean, luck is what we call, you know, when you do the same thing a billion times and you get three same results in a row. Like, oh, that's good luck because three happen in a row. It's like, well no, that's what we call it, yeah. Good luck. And so, yes, that exists. You know, some people do seem to be born with like a horseshoe up their ass, as they say, you know, where it's like everything, sure. You know, everything comes out, you know, like, God damn,
everything's
like
everything up he does, right?
To gold. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And so you do see people who variance is in their favor, as we say, right?
Yeah.
Like it's, you know, I mean, and that's what it is. It's variance and it's going to work out, you know, for some people. So in that way, luck exists, but I don't think it's a, you know, like a force that exists out there that lands on specific people. We just call good variance luck.
Yeah. I mean, that was a long-winded way to say, well, it's horseshit. Or no. Yeah, exactly. Just no.
Well, I like the superstition thing. It's funny. Like, well, one thing, like, so I do ceramics. I fire kilns.
Yeah.
And something that I learned a long time ago is you make what's called a kiln god. You make a little clay figure. You know, a little animal or a little person, you know, a little totem, and you put it in the kiln for good luck.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just a little thing people do. And, you know, I still do it. It's just, you know, I make cone packs, which are these little things you put in the kiln to look at how the temperature's going, you know, how the atmosphere's going in the kiln. And those are made out of wet clay, you know, before I fire the kiln. So I always have a little ball of clay left over, and I just squeeze together and make a little, you know, like a little dog sculpture, some, yeah. You know, some little thing, you know, some little goofy little alien animal. And I put it in the kiln, and it's, you kind of call it a superstition. It's kind of more for me, just like a little ritual, you know, just like a fun thing.
Right.
And, you know, if people come by the studio, they're like, what are all these things? You know, like, just because I always just
do you keep them all?
Well, yeah. I mean, eventually I just swipe a handful and throw them away. Like, I don't care. You know, they have right. No like real value, or people would come in and be like, oh my God, these are so cool. Like, we'll take as many as you want, yeah. You know, but it was just like a habit. And, you know, if I miss one, I don't open the kiln back up and put one in right. There, you know, like I'm not bound to it. Again, it's a long way of saying it's horse shit, but it's not that I don't have rituals.
Right. Sure. Have, you know, I mean, the reason I ask what we do for a living is it's gambling, you know, I mean, we're putting yeah. ourselves. So I think a lot of people are feel this, you know, a certain way about luck, like, okay, well, I'm going to this new town. I'm going, yeah. You know, I'm pushing all in into the pot. I'm putting $1,000 yeah. in. I'm putting $1,500 in. I've already paid for it and I haven't made anything.
Right.
So you're right. Just hoping. You have faith. You have luck. You have whatever. You're hoping, but you're putting your best work forward. And if it rains or if a storm takes you or somebody, you know, the wrong person doesn't come to the show, then it doesn't pay your mortgage. But so I do think that that is why a lot of us are. Because we look at it like gambling, but you've actually right. taken it to another point. You've been cutting down on your expenses on hotels lately. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not.
That's true. Well, yeah, I found it's not gambling. It turns out that there's some ways in the casino that you can go and you can actually, you know, you have variances. There's always variance, but you can put the odds in your favor.
Yeah.
And so you can, you know, you can, let's say, play blackjack and count cards, for example, and you know, get a couple percent advantage in your favor so that, you know, your expectation is that you will actually win money. Now, that doesn't always the case because variance says that you don't always win money, but over time you will if right. you're playing correctly. And so, but the other advantage to that is that if you play enough, then the casinos will comp you rooms so that you can stay for free. So, for example, I just did two shows in Kansas City, Brookside and Plaza, and I stayed at the casino for free the whole time. So, would that save me $1,000 at least, right?
At least.
Two weekends in Kansas City, especially yeah. the Chiefs game, I think both, well, definitely last weekend. And there was some other event the previous weekend. I don't remember if it was the Chiefs or encounter or not. But anyway, yeah, I mean, hotels are expensive. I mean, $100 a night at least, right? And so, you know, I figured, you know, eight nights saved me certainly $1,000. So, yeah, so I've been doing some card counting and a few other things and, you know, making some money that way. So, you know, it's fun. It's a little bit of a break, but it's definitely, I mean, some people just straight up gamble and I'm not really interested in that. You know, I mean, I play games when I think I have an advantage and it's mathematical. It's not that complicated.
Right.
And, you know, it's probably beyond the scope of what we want to talk about in the show, though I'm certainly willing. But, you know, if you follow the math, then yeah. And I've, you know, in a few years ago, I actually did really well. I made a fair amount, you know, doing that.
Yeah.
You know, had a pretty, you know, made quite a bit of money. It's funny, I went down to do a show down in Texas at Cottonwood. And so I left like a week early. And I went to Tunica. There's a bunch of casinos there. I played. I went to Shreveport and played. Then I went to, and I had made like $12,000 or something, nice, like on the way to the show, right? And then I get to Cottonwood, you know, set up, right? That's not the easiest setup because you got to, like, you know, dolly across the grass and you got to wait in line to set up. You know, nice little show, but it's not the easiest logistic.
Sure.
And then set up and did like $3,500 in sales. it was not good, right?
Yeah.
And not good. I drove 1,000 miles, right, to do that. And I was like, okay, well, this isn't any good. And then I, you know, broke down that show. Said, you know what? So then I drove back through Shreveport and then a couple of little spots in Mississippi and then up to Southern Illinois. There's another place there. Anyway, on that trip, you know, just on that run, I think I made about $18,000 in the casino.
Amazing.
Playing. And then I made $3,000 at the show. And I'm like, well, what the hell am I doing?
What are you doing?
Yeah, I got to just sat in the air conditioning, you know.
But that's your variance too, right? I mean, you've got to put yourself, like, clearly they're not, I mean, that's a great show. That's one that a lot of really great artists do, but it may not be your market and what you're looking for. So you're looking at your own variance with art shows and how you're picking the shows that you want to do, you know?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, I've done Cottonwood in the past and done, you know, much better than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just like my bad year, or, you know, I didn't have the right piece, or I went to the Port-a-John when my customer showed up or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
the gambling stink on you. You're acting like a Mr. Big Shot money bag.
Smelled like money too much. You know, like, oh, this guy doesn't need it. But yeah, you know, and of course the casino could go the other direction too. You know, could have lost, you know, money there too. But there is that sort of luck, or, you know, it's not luck, but we call it that, you know, the variance. Yeah, and that happens with shows. I mean, you know, show up and you do the right things. But, you know, we look at it long term, right? I mean, people will say, oh, you go to a show, you try it 2-3 times, and if you don't make money, then don't go back. I mean, sometimes, you know, you go and it's just definitely not your crowd, and, you know, don't go back after one.
There's some really great shows out there that I
did. I did. Yeah. First 2 years of Des Moines, I did it. I think I did $2,000 and $3,000, you know, like the first two. I mean, I was like, I can't sell. And ex-wife was a jeweler, and so she would do well. But so we'd both go, because she would do well and I wouldn't. So I just kind of sit there, you know, whatever, I'd pay for my booth, you know, hotel, but that was about it. You know, I didn't make any money. And I was like, this, I don't really get it, you know? And then, I don't know, something turned. I mean, it's the same work. I mean, a little bit better, but it wasn't like I changed my work, you know.
You know, sometimes that work is different enough that I could see the show taking a while. Sometimes that happens where it takes a while for the show to catch up to you.
My work is definitely different.
Yeah.
You know, people don't really know what to make of it. I mean, if I showed up at Pottery, it's like, well, people buy pots. They're like, okay, I like pots. Do I like these pots? And then I'm either going to buy your pots or I'm not.
Right.
But nobody's thinking about whether or not they like ceramic paint cans until they see them.
Yeah. I can't, you know, eat food off of this.
Yeah. Like, there, and nobody's thinking about, like, oh, I need a giant ceramic wrench in my house. I mean, that's not a conversation anybody ever has.
We've had that conversation.
Well, yeah. Well, until you get to that point.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, whether or not you need a bowl for your dining room table, that's a conversation
that's one
you've had in your life. And so yeah, my work is you know, it's a surprise to everybody.
It
because
is.
It's not something anybody's seen before. So, you know, and I recognize that. Yeah. And I mean, Des Moines has been good for me, no sense. You know, it was one of those things where, well, you know, I was really at the cusp of not doing, you know, I knew it was a good show, or, you know, everybody says, hey, great show, right? Mm-hmm. You got to do it. And I'm like, well, it wasn't for me until it became so. But then, you know, other shows, yeah, you have a good show that everybody says is great. And then, because even though I know, like, my work is so kind of odd. I mean, sometimes it's like, well, this isn't really ideal for art fairs, you know, a lot of what I do, right? Because it's, you know, people generally at art fairs are in a good mood. They want something in their house that makes them happy. You know, they want to buy something.
You're bumming everybody out.
Yeah. You know, and here I have this word is pretty, you know, it's kind of, some of it can be kind of dark and somber and serious and, you know, contemplative and that. And it's not that you can't sell that work, but the work that sells really well at art fairs is work that, you know, makes people happy, makes them feel good. At least it doesn't make them think too hard about shit they don't want to think about. I don't mean that work can't make people think, or that it that there isn't a place for that work, but it's just a lot harder to sell that work, especially because, you know, people are in a certain kind of mood. You know, they're having a cocktail, they're out with their friends, they're having a good time. You know, there's a party atmosphere. I mean, I sell my work, so I'm going to make my living. You know, it's not hard. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm not doing it.
Right.
But you know, work that is, that's, you know, that just makes people feel better about themselves is going to be more successful. So to that end, some of what you asked earlier, you know, some of that work, the pieces that I've made that are, you know, not as sobering, you know, those sell well.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a piece that's like a ball and chain, you know, it's got, you look, American flag. It's like, oh, wow, that's like about slavery and imprisonment and history and blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah. You know, the woman came up one time and she goes, that is a motherfucking essay. You know, you know, like, yeah. It was like, you know, it's like it tells a big story.
It does.
Like, yeah, we had a long conversation. It's like, that to me is like, that's that level of work that I'd strive for. How do you say a lot in a very succinct format, right? So if I can, you know, make a ball and chain with the American flag on it, that probably says a lot. There's a lot of different things. People say, oh, that's about imprisonment, that's about taxes, you know, that's about slavery, that's about, you know, what's it like to be the weight of being the best in the world, you know, whatever people want to bring to it. You know, all those things can be true, or you can argue them, but, you know, making things that have, you know, make people have a conversation, to me, is very, very important. But to that end, you know, it's like a lot of people, they don't want to have that hanging in their living
room. Right.
Because when they hang in their living room, they want to relax and just be with their family and have a good time. Now, some people do, right? I mean, it's not like it doesn't exist, but it just becomes more challenging.
It does.
And that's back to, you know, before when I was saying, well, you know, these people aren't stupid because they're not buying my work that I think is so sophisticated and interesting and, you know, says all these important things, which, who gives a shit what I say? You know, it doesn't matter. But, you know, I have to relook at that and say, well, it's not because, you know, people are stupid or they're foolish and they don't get my brilliance, right? It has nothing to do with that. It's like, what do people want to live with? You know, how do people want to live their lives? You got to connect with that.
Yeah.
How do people want to live? And you find a way to be a part of that.
You do. I mean, you don't want to necessarily constantly be reminded of it. You don't want to be.
Yeah. You know. I mean, your work does that, right? I mean, you're telling a story, which is overall like a nice story. You know, it's a good story, right?
Some of them are, for sure. And then sometimes
there's some challenges in there.
Right. And I've done a couple of, you know, there was a Native American territory map in my parents'. Well, it's in my parents' house, but it was in my grandparents' house. And I used to love looking at it when I was a kid, whenever I'd go to my grandparents' house, and it was like the Indian territories of Fort Leavenworth to the Great Salt Lake, and it has New Mexico in there. So I did this series of pieces using that map as collage. I did a high-res scan, and I did a bunch of reading about moving out west when I moved to Santa Fe. And I created this piece on top of the map of the horses, and it's like, well, what's my place in history of moving out west? And so there was a member of the cartography team that drew that map that then moved out to Salt Lake City. Carrington, he was his name. And I started thinking about that. I'm like, okay, here's my privilege as just a little white little boy growing up, looking at the map, thinking cowboys and Indians. And then you start growing up and you realize, like, well, what's the dark history that map took part in? Like, why did they even draw that map? It's like, well, it was to control those people that lived out there. And that's horrible. So I've got this pretty painting of a horse, some wild horses on top of that map. And it's like, well, if you really get into it and you start talking to me about that piece, it's like, well, that I drew that because the army used to round the horses up to control the tribes. They'd round their horses up and kill them so that they couldn't move from place to place. And it's like, am I going to tell that story every time? No, I'd never sell it. But I know what that story is. And sometimes people really want to engage in it. But,
for that, your audience starts to get real small and get serious like
it
that.
It does.
You know, like a real good buddy of mine, he doesn't do art fairs like this. He does, you know, gallery shows, and he makes his work. It's, you know, kind of like apocalyptic, you know, figures. You know, he's really beautiful, kind of, you know, Rubenesque figures, but in these apocalyptic landscapes. So it's very modern, but with a very like old masters feel to it.
Right.
And, But he goes, yeah, it's really hard to sell paintings to people if the paintings make them want to kill themselves. I'm like, yeah, I mean, of course.
That's a drawback.
Yeah, it's a drawback. But, you know, you're talking about that Native American thing. I was reading Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. Yeah. And it's brutal.
It's incredible.
It's a great, I think I've got just a little bit left, but that's pretty brutal saying. And yeah, so, you know, you make these serious things, you know, these pieces that are, you know, very serious and heady. And I think it's really important. Some people are going to hate me for saying it, but like, as a serious artist, I think it's important to deal with some serious stuff. I don't think your work has to all be that.
Yeah.
But I think that, I think you owe it to, you know, the world, because I think our job, we decided to have this job, right? No one hired us. You know, we've created this job for ourselves. And, you know, you can, you know, go out and, you know, make a bunch of goofy things and sell them and, you know, just make a product and, you know, buy a yacht with it, you know, and that's fine, you know, whatever. But, you know, I feel like a little bit of, I feel a lot of responsibility to the world, right? Like trying to make it better. And I think an artist is a really, there's a lot of ways that we can make it better. And one of those is to make people think. You know, you asked me about superstition and I gave you that long answer earlier, but it's like, it's very important to me that people, you know, look at evidence and believe in things, right? Have a scientific way of looking at the world. And I think, you know, artists who have to deal with like serious and hard issues, at least sometimes, you know, that's a sort of our, I don't know. I'll just say, I think it's part of our responsibility.
It is.
You know, to, you can make fun work, silly work. I mean, I'm all for that. And maybe you make these difficult pieces and you don't show them at art fairs, you know, but I think it's important, you know, for us to do that.
It is.
To do that work. I do a lot of it, so maybe I'm carrying, you know, maybe other people can fuck around more and make stuff. And, you know,
you
and
can that's carry fine. The load.
I can carry more of the load. And yeah. I'm just not going to do that other kind of work because it's just not my personality.
Right.
And so I'm fine when we need that fun work because we need people to have happy stuff in their homes for their kids to be excited about and for them to be excited about.
Plus it breaks up a show. You can't think every.
And it breaks up a show. If it's all like heavy and somber. Yeah. Everybody comes and they just like, everybody's in a bad mood. You know? But you need a couple serious guys mixed in there. Is good,
right.
You know? I mean, I don't even know if my work like feels that serious up front.
But there's if you really get into it, there's a contemplation there that has to take place.
I think so. Yeah.
I think that's a great place to kind of wrap this up because you nailed it. You know, we do have that responsibility to ourselves, if that's what we're thinking, you know, and there are artists think a certain way and we owe that to the audience. And sometimes other people's visions are to just say something light and yeah. That has its place too. But I don't know. I appreciate your place.
We have to have revelry and, you know, dance and things that don't necessarily make sense. Right.
100%. You know,
yeah, we got to have that. I mean, I'm certainly a proponent of fun. You know?
Yeah.
You can quote me there.
I had a bunch of other questions and things that I don't even want to get to because I think we covered, we did a deep dive on the stuff that I really wanted to talk about. And I appreciate you very much.
Always, man. You know, it's always great to hang out.
Yeah.
Great to talk.
All right, brother. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you a lot.
All right, Will. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye. Later.
That was pretty cool. I enjoyed listening to you guys. Really great talk, Will.
You know, when I was a DJ, Douglas, a music DJ, and I was particularly stressed out and I didn't have time to put my show together, I would lean into what fits. And it was super easy to talk to Michael because I've heard him talking through the years about his artwork. It was nice to take a deep dive on what he thinks about art. I have a feeling, you know, through the years of talking to him, I've known him for a long time, but to get a deep dive and really get inside his head about what makes him tick, it was really helpful for me.
Something I found interesting in his talk was the idea about whimsy almost seeming effortless, and it made me think about when I've heard interviews with actors who do comedic roles versus dramatic roles and how they have said straight up comedy is a lot harder. And so I do feel like there is a thoughtfulness to that kind of lighter side of things. Sometimes the stuff that seems effortless is the work that is hard.
But I think also there's a certain, like what you said about comedy, comedians, like it's actually harder to do comedy than it is like really great comics like Robin Williams it was pretty easy for Robin Williams to jump in and do serious acting, as opposed to, like, he'd already done the hard part with the comedy. The comedy was hard. It's actually easier to be serious. So Jim Carrey, when he goes into Eternal Sunshine, was an amazing actor. And you're like, oh my God, this guy is so good. Well, like, well, all he had to do was to rein all that stuff in already and just be quiet. So I think there's some importance in whimsy, and there is some importance in thoughtfulness. And it doesn't mean it has to be, you know, drop dead serious all the time. It just is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, with graphic design, if everything's bold, then nothing's bold.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps to break up a show, too, to have, like, you know, your Michael Schwagman next to, you know, next to Anthony Pack, next to Dylan Straczynski, next to me, next to...
It makes a show.
It does. That's what the show's all about.
And I don't know that our collectors are one thing or the other either. They like to have things side by side that make them feel different things for different reasons. So it's all good. And I just loved hearing where Michael is in his design and his thoughtfulness to his approach and to his work.
Yeah, I like that too. It was nice to sit down with him, and I appreciate him being so honest. And that honestly is the only way Michael Schwagman can be. He's exactly he's exactly as advertised. That's so right. Thanks again for sitting down with me.
Will, I think we need to get our butts back in the studio because we got a lot to do before Bayou City this week. So,
yep, I'm going to try to make some good work, Douglas. I'll see you here in a couple weeks. We have some exciting things planned for the future. Not ready to quite announce them yet. Check in on the Facebook page, the Independent Artist Podcast, for announcements about future interviews. But for now, let's just say goodbye and get back to work.
Take care, man, and we'll see y'all down the road.
Happy birthday, my friend.
You too.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Association of Independent Artists. The website is naiaartists.org.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. That's zapplication.org. And while you're at it, check out Will's website at willarmstrongart.com and my website at sigwithglass.com.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to be notified when we release new episodes.